welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
And I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 218th episode of the Nauticast, titled The Lonely God, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, Daenerys 6, in which Dany finishes things up in Meereen, leaves the city in good hands, and sets out for Westeros. She'll get there in the next book, an exceeding of expectations. I can't wait.
It's the Martin Dickens collab we've all been waiting for.
I think those two could get together on Arya and her various little gangs of orphans that she gets in the Riverlands and Braavos. I could see Charles Dickens loving those. So our spoiler warning is always, prepare to be spoiled for all 5 novels, the 3 Duncan Egg novellas, any histories, interviews, Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows. Anything and everything. And speaking of House of the Dragon, we usually get a question from one of our patrons at the top of our regular episodes. So if you want to go ahead over to patreon.com/nauticastasoiaf, our Sworn Sword and higher level tiers, get to ask us questions that we answer at the front of every ASOF episode. So go ahead and send them in. If you're already one of our patrons, feel free to send in one of our questions. We always send in one of your questions. We always love answering them. But this week, of course, we just got hit with a trailer. I'm sorry, trailers for House of the Dragon for season 2. So we thought we'd talk about that up top. So what'd you think, sir?
Well, we have to start with just the fact that they released 2. The trailer has 2 heads, apparently. And I think it's brilliant. Anyone who's followed me or listened to our season 1 coverage, I kind of bemoan some of the factionalism and the discourse about Team Black versus Team Green, but I do think it is just expert marketing. Not just marketing, I think it's actually expert framing of the story, because it is 2 viewpoints, like really going at it, even if we, you know, necessarily think one might be better or more right than the other. I think it is worth kind of approaching it with that kind of Martin point of view structure in mind, even though, you know, Fire and Blood doesn't have that point of view structure. But I do really like it, you know, Team Iron Man versus Team Captain America. Let's go again. It really, you know, it drives interest, it drives engagement. Whether it'll drive the discourse into good places, we shall see on that. But it also, because, you know, trailers are as much about tone as it is about, what's it called, showing the things and the Easter eggs and trying to read sigils off people's armor. It's really about setting the tone. So, first of all, having the 2 trailers, that sets a tone. And then I feel like each of them, like, kind of has a unique tone to it. Like, it almost feels like, without really, like, picking a side here, like, Team Green feels very into, like, justifying what they're doing here. And the Team Black one, especially the way it ends with Rhaenyra, like, kind of being like, what have I unleashed? It feels almost, like, apologetic. Like, it definitely feels like one team's more fuck yeah than the other. One's like, I can't wait to face Daemon down, you know, and the other one's just like, oh no, what is happening here? And I don't think that's like absolute. And I think there's a little bit of both, but I really do like that. It gives us those point of views, and it also gives us those point of views with the kind of ideology that these teams necessarily have to bring into this battle or engagement or war.
Like you said on Twitter, like, you know, that the green versus black stuff can be so stupid when it comes down to people actually interpreting the story. But as marketing, it's genius. It's perfect. It's the same like as the people running copy for Immaculate, the Sydney Sweeney movie, listing all the horrified quotes from like Christian reviewers as advertising. Like they know exactly who they're trying to get to watch, who they're going to be farming engagement from. But the actual trailers themselves do remind me of George's POV structure, and that they actually are pretty thoughtful in terms of how they engage with how these people are justifying themselves, like you say, how the greens have to kind of immediately talk themselves back into hype mode after Luke's death, and how Team Black is kind of just caught between grief and rage. It's pretty effective, and I think but it is interesting to think about, because one of the big questions hovering over this show is, how is it going to play out relative to how people reacted to season 8? And it's, as always, it's very possible to overstate how people reacted to season 8. I think, you know, it's easy to hype up certain media reactions and certain fan reactions, but the shows were still hugely watched overall, and a lot of people still reacted mostly positively to season 8, but still, the last thing they want to do is have that kind of reaction. And part of me thinks, like, hyping up the green versus black stuff is a way to create that reaction again when you get to the end and everyone's dead or miserable. More so than the end of Thrones. Like, no, zero characters are happy at the end of this story. But, that it's, like you say, it's still kind of built into, especially the black trailer, that kind of despair is already setting in. So it is already there. So I think they're managing expectations well, which is kind of a bloodless compliment. But I mean it as a compliment. I think they know what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it does make sense too, where we left things at season one with the death of Jacerys, right? Is that the kid that died?
Luke.
Or no, Luke. Lucerys. Yeah. Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Damn wiener kids. Can't keep them straight.
Strong boys. Who needs
them? But it would make sense that they would come into the season more with rage. That's why the black trailer starts with shots of a funeral pyre that looks pretty much like it's probably Lucerys's funeral. And uh-huh. It's kind of like, that's kind of the building block for where Team Black is going to start the season. Just like otherwise, is there just like cool shit in the trailer you liked or anything that you thematically seized on that you really enjoyed?
Well, Alicent, as always, she was such a highlight of season one, and she's great in the green trailer. Immediately putting things in terms of storytelling and how to have this narrative that they were always rightful. Everyone's just kind of posturing for the history books. Everyone's got an eye towards that here. And she says, Rhaenyra's supporters will believe what they wish. Nothing to engage with, nothing to even be aware of. And she has that, yeah, that great line about Aegon have no idea what the sacrifices are, because, I mean, Alicent just can't let her ex-girlfriend win. That's the biggest sacrifice for her is giving up that relationship. They're clearly still leaning into that. Yeah, I loved the little bit we got of Aemond, because he's also one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. They're setting up the Daemon versus Aemond stuff, although that's definitely not going to happen this season. They're going to have to pile in as many awesome things as they can into season two, because a lot of the more directly cathartic fuck yeah shit is season three and potentially four.
I think if I'm going to make a prediction, I would say I bet you they're going to do like the Littlefinger Varys thing, both with Daemon, Aemond, and Alicent and Rhaenyra. Just like find a way to get them in a room for one scene each season.
That's a good idea.
And I think, you know, maybe kind of doing that will be a good build up to the God's Eye for Aemond and Daemon specifically. Like,
that's
maybe
true.
Not quite fight, but have that kind of stare down or something like that.
Yeah, and Harrenhal is easy for that because they do cross over in the Riverlands. that's something I'm looking forward to this season when we get to the end and Aegon is like horribly burned and looks like the guy in RoboCop who gets covered in nuclear waste. Mm-hmm. And then Aemond is like, I'm the king now. My solution is to burn half the country down. That's going to be fun. But yeah, they're clearly teasing that anime villain fight. So that's fun to look forward to. What about you? What stood out?
I really like what they're doing with Alicent again. Like you, I just really loved everything Alicent related from season one and Olivia Cooke's performance. Uh-huh. It looks like they're playing equal parts Ophelia and Kendall Roy into her character for the season.
The dream character combination right
yes,
there.
Yes, absolutely. They got those shots of her not drowning herself, but like, you know, submerging herself probably in a bathtub. But, you know, that can be very evocative, you know, of those characters of suicide, of, you know, just wanting to give up kind of. But you know, I think that was great. I can't remember the actor's name who plays Aegon, but I love that kid. It's like
Tom Glenn Carney.
Tom Glenn Carney. He brings such like joy to such an unlikable character. It's really fun. It's not quite Joffrey level and it's not supposed to be, but you can see that he's got that little pep in his step, like, to war then, huh? Let's go. It's just really engaging in a very fun way, in a way that you kind of love to hate. So it really is coming off like I'm team green here. Maybe I am. I also like that Kristen Cole got the Jaime Lannister haircut. I guess that's a Kingsguard thing
issue.
They
yeah,
do
exactly.
Is like after a season or two, we got to trim those long locks and, you know, get you down to a good crew cut to be defending the king.
Right. They send you to the army barber. You get like the full metal jacket scene where they just cut you on the line. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he looked good. He always looks good.
And then I think last of all, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit, is we get to see a little bit of the North in the black trailer. We see what looks like a party, like just kind of riding horses, a little caravan in the North, as well as Jace and presumably Craig and Stark on top of the wall. I think our friends over at Learned Hands podcast spotted ice on Craigan's back. That's gonna be really exciting because that's very much just like kind of a footnote. At least this part of Craigan's story is really not anything in Fire and Blood, but because of the, you know, Stark IP, I guess, the brand recognizability. I can definitely see them boosting up the Stark content and the Northern content in this. And that gives them, you know, a lot of room to play with. And I think one thing I'm excited about is season one very much took Fire and Blood as guidelines, but because of changes they made, like, say, aging Alicent up and things like that, they kind of told their own story. They told about events that aren't even mentioned in Fire and Blood. And I'm just wondering, as we move into a part of the dance that is kind of better documented in Fire and Blood, whether they still kind of stick to kind of playing in those margins, or if they kind of focus in on hitting the bigger beats as we know them from the book.
Yeah, that's a good question, whether we're just getting teased in the North with this season, if there's going to be anything set up there in later seasons. I'm kind of caught in between, like, excitement and dread about this part of the show, because part of me is like, yeah, this has nothing to do with what's actually going on in the story right now. There's nothing conceivably dramatic that can happen here unless they, like, make up a White Walker attack.
which
would be cool, but deeply stupid. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, like, it's so outside the plot that, yeah, it does feel like checking in with places you know and people you might like, which I'm kind of allergic to in general.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I do desperately want to know more about, like, I want them to follow up on the breadcrumbs they threw from the table about the Song of Ice and Fire and the prophecy. Like, any scrap of attention to the magical side of things, I'm all in for. So any hint of lore that they might be casually dropping in, I will be all into. I am, and this is also looking at the trailer, like you were saying about kind of the Black trailer being kind of more despairing and, like, hints of rage. And it looks like Jace is one kind of making the case, like the affirmative case for Rhaenyra to Cregan Stark. And I'm curious if he's going to be able to, like, carry that plot. Like, he's you were saying about Aegon, he's one of the more just kind of fun and weaselly and enjoyable characters. Same with Aemon and Daemon. And the Strong Boys are just kind of, like, earnest. So yes. I'm just like, I'm wondering, like, and so are the Starks generally. So it's like, I'm wondering about that plot. How is it? It could be, like, really cool, I think, in terms of the world building and lore, but I'm worried, like, dramatically, it might be. I'm curious what they come up with to, like, make those scenes have tension.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good call. I think it's a good call calling back to the prophecy, too, because if you want to give Jace something to do up at the wall, maybe he checks the Winterfell libraries or the library at the wall or something. And,
good point.
Hey, do you got anything on this? I mean, I don't know if that makes for compelling television. I think, you know,
you get the Gandalf scene where he's drinking down in the Gondor vault. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, speed through world building is the fantasy trick to making it work, right? You never want to bear people down too much. And I'm curious. You know, it's one of those things, I think, if you look at a lot of fantasy and sci-fi stories, like, a lot of the drama and urgency comes from societies that are falling apart. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stories I think people react to as boring or slower, stories that are about societies that are doing just fine. Because I'm like, then, well, why do I... And, like, the wall in the north right now are kind of doing just fine. So yes. I'm curious as how they make that threat. But, like, something else I liked in the trailers was the sense of kind of this... that divide between the two sides, between the Black and the Green, kind of working itself out fractally through the rest of the country, with the Kingsguard, obviously, the Twins kind of being the most direct expression of it, but also we see a flash of the Blackwoods versus Brackens, that old fight, the Valyrians and the Hightowers, that was kind of built up in season one. They're kind of come back to it here about the two great kind of overproud naval powers and how there's just not enough room in this town for the two of them. So... I think they did a good job of starting in season one. I hope they kind of build season two around even the northern stuff, is tracing how this divide in the royal family kind of gives everyone else an excuse to pursue shit that maybe they were always getting ready to. And everyone kind of forms the battle lines on that basis.
Yeah, the bifurcation is pretty cool. I there's also some shots that really mirror each other between the Green and Black trailer. I think of the dragon shot specifically. Excuse me if I misnamed the dragons here, but I believe there's the shot of Sunfire in the dragon pit, and then it's opposed against, or in the Black trailer, it's Syrax on the beach of Dragonstone or something similar, but they're basically, like, framed and shot the exact same way, so it's basically like they just swapped out backgrounds and did a little touch-up on the dragons for their individual thing, so... I like that they understand that these are in conversation with each other. There's the shot of Aegon sitting down on the Iron Throne. And in the Green trailer, that's like Alicent's like, this is what we're doing it for. And in the Black trailer, you know, it's Rhaenyra being like, they took it from us. And they use that same footage very well, and it fits very well together. So I'm excited. I think if nothing else, the amount of thought that went into this kind of trailer presentation and tease, you know, is very promising. I remember sitting and watching a block of ice melt for 5 hours to get a date. And I remember a text message campaign that didn't really work. I really feel like this is something where they're just like, let's just do some banger trailers here. People are already excited. The first season was quite a success. I think they know they're cooking with gas, and I'm excited to see what they got coming for us.
They're both the marketing people and I think the people making the show are very canny and very clever, and I think they know how to get the most out of the story they're working with. Mm-hmm. That was my big takeaway from season one, and I think that's probably going to be true again. And I love watching Aegon just make fun of everyone and roast everyone from the Iron Throne is going to be great, because he is kind of like Joffrey or like Renly. Mm-hmm. Or like, I feel like, you know, if we'd seen young Griff on the show, that would have been
that'd be great
kind of vibe. And then against that you have the smoldering resentment of someone like Stannis or Rhaenyra at this point. And it's a good dynamic because, of course, I would want to punch Aegon in the face too. Get off that throne, you jerk. But as we see in the Black trailer, there's the horror of everything you're going to do to get to that point. And then Rhaenys, I imagine, as Rhaenys did a lot in season one, kind of was just like the voice of wisdom and like speaking for the writers a lot of the time. And she speaks toward the end of the Black trailer. She's talking about, you won't even remember how this started. Basically saying everything in these two trailers is bullshit. You're all just trying to justify yourselves. None of this is going to be why you're actually doing it. And specifically when she says, when the desire to burn and kill takes hold and reason is forgotten, which reminds me a lot of something that the log lady in Twin Peaks says in the movie of Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. She says to Laura Palmer about Laura getting into darker and more corrupt stuff. The log lady says, when this kind of fire starts, it is very hard to put out. The tender boughs of innocence burn first, and the wind rises, and then all goodness is in jeopardy. So I don't know if it's a deliberate reference or not, but it's very similar vibes of that kind of horror at the transition from innocence into corruption. And it's watching all the Targaryens in their various forms kind of fall into that is that sense of dread, I think, is something that they lean on pretty hard towards the end of season one. And I hope that's just the mood of season two. Just endless dread. Speaking of which,
are you referring to the chapter we're going to cover or our lives that we are living?
Yes. Speaking of the Targaryens, we are here today to talk about A Storm of Swords, Daenerys 6. So let's jump into the synopsis. Dany broke her fast under the persimmon tree that grew in the terrace garden. Watching her dragons chase each other about the apex of the Great Pyramid where the huge bronze harpy once stood. Meereen had a score of lesser pyramids, but none stood even half as tall. From here she could see the whole city, the narrow twisty alleys and wide brick streets, the temples and granaries, hovels and palaces, brothels and baths, gardens and fountains, the great red circles of the fighting pits. And beyond the walls was the Pewter Sea, the winding Skahazadan, the dry brown hills, burnt orchards, and blackened fields. No, you didn't miss a chapter. Dany really is inside Meereen, even though when her last chapter ended, she was very much not inside Meereen. We'll catch you up when George does. For the moment, he wants us to know that Dany feels like a god up here. Although that's less fun than it might sound. Dany is lonely, just like she thinks the gods must be. According to Missandei, the people of Noth worship the Lord of Harmony, who created everything and everyone. Dany thinks he sounds even lonelier than her. Westeros officially has 7 gods, but Viserys always said that the 7 were actually 1, which just confuses Dany. Welcome to religion, kid. It doesn't get easier in real life. As for the Red Priests, they of course believe in 2 gods forever at war, which Dany doesn't like either. She doesn't want to always be at war. Well, Dany, how are you at receiving unspeakably awful news? Missandei brings Dany some food, as well as some wine she has to fight the flies for. Apparently they don't have flies on Noth, just butterflies. That's how utopian it is for the peaceful people. Except for when the slavers come calling. Dany promises to take Missandei home, mindful that she should have made the same promise out loud to Jorah. Missandei says that she'd rather stay with Dany, and helps the queen dress. Today she wore a robe of purple samite and a silver sash, and on her head the 3-headed dragon crown the Tourmaline Brotherhood had given her in Qarth. Her slippers were silver as well, with heels so high that she was always half afraid she was about to topple over. When she was dressed, Missandei brought her a polished silver glass so she could see how she looked. Dany stared at herself in silence. Is this the face of a conqueror? So far as she could tell, she still looked like a little girl. No one was calling her Daenerys the Conqueror yet, but perhaps they would. Aegon the Conqueror had won Westeros with 3 dragons, but she had taken Marine with sewer rats and a wooden cock in less than a day. We'll get to the sewer rats, but let's start with the wooden cock. Over Grolio's objections, Danny tore her three ships apart to create siege engines and battering rams. One of the rams, formerly of the ship Joso's Prank, got the nickname Joso's Cock, and it broke down the eastern gate of Marine. Who says George sucks at sex scenes? Danny had wanted to lead the attack herself, but to a man, her captain said that would be madness, and her captains never agreed on anything. Instead, she remained in the rear, sitting atop her silver in a long shirt of mail. She heard the city fall from half a league away, though, when the defenders' shouts of defiance changed to cries of fear. Her dragons had roared as one in that moment, filling the night with flame. The slaves are rising, she knew at once. My sewer rats have gnawed off their chains. Nope, still no explanation for that. Be patient. You're waiting for TWOW, you can wait for this. Danny rode into Marine after her freedmen shifted the piles of corpses to make room. The slaves cheer her as she passes. The former masters, not so much. They're stripped naked and forced to await her in front of the Great Pyramid. Danny demands they give up 163 of their own, one for each of the slave children they crucified on the path to Marine. She had them nailed to wooden posts around the plaza, each man pointing at the next. The anger was fierce and hot inside her when she gave the command. It made her feel like an avenging dragon. But later, when she passed the men dying on the posts, when she heard their moans and smelled their bowels and blood, Danny put the glass aside, frowning. It was just. It was. I did it for the children. I'm sure the children would cheer you on, but sadly the dead are still dead. I say sadly, but I don't want the dead coming back. We've already seen what that looks like in Westeros. I don't need an army of dead babies. No thanks. Danny took the Great Pyramid as her own, destroying the harpy throne within and replacing it with a simple bench. I approve, but the Myrinese don't, saying it's not worthy of a queen. Danny's blood riders are, let's say, less minimalist, having claimed gold and silver and jewels from the dead, as has Daria Naharis. But Grey Worm wears the same uniform as ever. These at least she could rely on, or so she hoped. And Brown Ben Plum as well, solid Ben with his gray-white hair and weathered face, so beloved of her dragons. And Dario beside him, glittering in gold. Dario and Ben Plum, Grey Worm, Eerie, Jiqui, Missandei. As she looked at them, Danny found herself wondering which of them would betray her next. I feel like even before A Dance with Dragons, the smart money was always on Ben Plum. Survivors are not known for their loyalty. For the moment, though, Ben reports that the city is at peace, at least relative to the sack. Now that Danny's in charge, she's restored the queen's justice, hanging killers and castrating rapists. But, as Dario points out, the corpses only seem to draw more flies. Danny orders Grey Worm to start removing the master's corpses. On Missandei's advice, she allows their families to bury the bones. And that's that. Now we're all best friends. Next, Danny holds court. First up is Gale, an envoy from Astapor, speaking on behalf of King Cleon the Great. And who the hell is that? Danny asks. I left a bunch of white mages in charge of Astapor. Gale claims those nerds were plotting to restore slavery. Citation needed. And so the great and mighty Cleon hacked their heads off with a meat cleaver, as the great and mighty tend to do. Why a cleaver, you might ask? Cleon's not just auditioning for his own Blumhouse slasher movie here. Turns out that Missandei knows this guy. He was a famous butcher. So now Astapor has a literal butcher king. And next in line at the slaughterhouse is Yunkai. Danny reminds Gale that she made peace with the so-called wise masters of Yunkai, but Gale says that the masters aren't keeping that peace. And yeah, heartbreaking, the worst person you know just made a pretty good point. The wise masters are already training new soldiers, sending out envoys, and hiring sellswords. Cleon wants to team up with Danny to take them down, and he wants to seal that alliance with, what else, a marriage. Danny tells Gale that she'll consider it, and has him taken to his rooms before her skin starts literally crawling. All my victories turn to dross in my hands, she thought. Whatever I do, all I make is death and horror. When word of what had befallen Astapor reached the streets, as it surely would, tens of thousands of newly freed Myrinese slaves would doubtless decide to follow her when she went west, for fear of what awaited them if they stayed. Yet it might well be that worse would await them on the march. Even if she emptied every granary in the city and left Marine to starve, how could she feed so many? The way before her was fraught with hardship, bloodshed, and danger. Ser Jorah had warned her of that. He'd warned her of so many things. No, I will not think of Jorah Mormont. Let him keep a little longer. Just keep slow rolling those sewer rats, George. We've got nothing but time, apparently. Next up is a Carthene ship captain who gives her a less biased version of what's going on in Astapor. It is, once again, hell on earth. Cleon is letting people fight, starve, die, and rot in the streets, while he focuses on turning highborn boys into the next generation of Unsullied. Dany thinks back to Irohe, the Lazarine girl she tried but failed to protect from Khal Drogo's warriors, and she fears the same fate, writ large, awaits Meereen. So anyway, what does the ship captain want? Slaves. Naturally. Dany points out that they have no slaves here anymore. That's kind of the whole point. But Daario says that there are many freedmen down on the docks trying to sell themselves back into slavery. Specifically, these are the well-educated freedmen. Your tutors, your scribes, your healers. Unlike the Unsullied or the kids crucified by the masters, these folks had relatively nice lives before Dany came, lacking only their freedom. Now they have their freedom, but nothing much to show for it. Dany decides that anyone who wants to sell themselves into slavery can do so, but they can't sell their partners, nor their children. Missandei recommends that Dany tax the transactions in order to rebuild their treasury. Daario volunteers to take charge of that, and of course he does. Dany thinks he wants some of that gold for himself. But she's awfully short on honest men these days, so she agrees on the condition that literate freedmen are present to keep records. His business done, the captain of the Indigo Star bowed and took his leave. Dany shifted uncomfortably on the ebony bench. She dreaded what must come next, yet she knew she had put it off too long already. Yunkai and Astapor, threats of war, marriage proposals, the March West looming over all. I need my knights. I need their swords, and I need their counsel. Yet the thought of seeing Jorah Mormont again made her feel as if she'd swallowed a spoonful of flies. Angry, agitated, sick. We've got the Knight of Flowers. I think Jorah can be the Knight of Flies. That fits his personality. Dany orders Strong Belwis to bring forth her good knights. There are study in contrasts. Barristan walks proudly with his head held high, his shaven face making him look younger, whereas Jorah stares at the floor and looks older than ever. They halted before the bench. Strong Belwis stepped back and stood with his arms crossed across his scarred chest. Ser Jorah cleared his throat. Khaleesi. She had missed his voice so much. Not even Ian Glenn's, and she misses it. But she had to be stern. Be quiet. I will tell you when to speak. She stood. When I sent you down into the sewers, part of me hoped I'd seen the last of you. It seemed a fitting end for liars to drown in slavers' filth. I thought the gods would deal with you, but instead you returned to me. My gallant knights of Westeros, an informer and a turncloak. My brother would have hanged you both.
Viserys would have, anyway. She did not know what Rhaegar would have done.
I will admit you helped me win this city.
Ser Jorah's mouth tightened.
We won you this city. We sewer rats.
Be quiet, she said again, though there was truth to what he said. While Joso's cock and the other rams were battering the city gates, and her archers were firing flights of flaming arrows over the walls, Dany had sent 200 men along the river under cover of darkness to fire the hulks in the harbor. But that was only to hide their true purpose. As the flaming ships drew the eyes of the defenders on the walls, a few half-mad swimmers found the sewer mouths and pried loose a rusted iron grating. Ser Jorah, Ser Barristan, Strong Belwis, and 20 brave fools slipped beneath the brown water and up the brick tunnel. A mixed force of sellswords, Unsullied, and freedmen. Dany had told them to choose only men who had no families. And preferably no sense of smell. They had been lucky as well as brave. It had been a moon's turn since the last good rain, and the sewers were only thigh high. The oilcloth they wrapped around their torches kept them dry, so they had light. A few of the freedmen were frightened of the huge rats until Strong Belwis caught one and bit it in two. One man was killed by a great pale lizard that reared up out of the dark water to drag him off by the leg, but when the next ripples were spied, Ser Jorah butchered the beast with his blade. They took some wrong turnings, but once they found the surface, Strong Belwis led them to the nearest fighting pit, where they surprised a few guards and struck the chains off the slaves. Within an hour, half the fighting slaves in Meereen had risen. All right, whew, we finally found out who the sewer rats are. Thanks for listening, rate and review us. Oh wait, Dany's still talking. She acknowledges that both Jorah and Barristan have repeatedly saved her life, but as Stannis would say, those good deeds don't wash out the bad, and it's time to account for the latter. First up, Barristan. Dany wants to know why the White Knight fought for Rhaegar on the Trident, but then chose to serve Robert rather than follow Dany and Viserys into exile. Barristan explains that he was impressed by Robert choosing to spare him after the battle, along with many others. But more to the point, with Rhaegar dead, Robert was just the best choice available. Viserys was only a child, and unlike Rhaegar, it was already clear that he was his father's son.
His father's son? Dany frowned. What does that mean?
The old knight did not blink.
Your father is called the Mad King in Westeros. Has no one ever told you?
Viserys did.
The Mad King.
The usurper called him that. The usurper and his dogs. the Mad King. It was a lie. Why ask for truth? Sir Barristan said softly, if you close your ears to it.
Ah, but speaking of truth, it just keeps getting harder for Danny to hear. Barristan confesses that the main reason he kept his identity secret from Danny was not actually to hide from the Lannisters. It was to give him a chance to judge her, evaluate whether she had the taint.
Taint?
Danny bristled.
I am no maester to quote history at you, your grace. Swords have been my life, not books. But every child knows that the Targaryens have always danced too close to madness. Your father was not the first. King J. Harris once told me that madness and greatness are two sides of the same coin. Every time a new Targaryen is born, he said, the gods toss the coin in the air, and the world holds its breath to see how it will land.
Dany is not interested in the big defining metaphor of her family, though. She's more focused on, well, the family themselves. Barristan knew her family better than Jorah or even Viserys ever did. Maybe he's worth keeping around. He has to earn it, though. Dany proposes that Barristan serve her not as a knight, but as a fool, or maybe a cook. Fine by me, says Barristan. Get ready for the crappiest meals this side of the Red Wedding. And so he passes the test. Dany declares Barristan to be her knight and allows him to swear himself to her service. But on the inside, she has already moved on to dealing with Jorah, which she knows is going to be a lot less easy. Even with the bar that low, Jorah manages to dig his way under it, starting off by giving himself credit for warning Dany against everyone else. Dany grows angrier, what a shock, and demands to know when Jorah stopped spying on her. He admits that he was still sending reports from Karth. Jorah insists that after Khal Drogo died, he tried to get Dany to go east in order to keep her safe from Varys. But then Dany realizes that Jorah must have been the one who told Robert that she was pregnant with Drogo's child. Barristan confirms it, having been right there in the room when Robert ordered Dany killed. Jorah points out that he saved Dany from that assassination attempt, but it's too late.
He should have begun by begging forgiveness. She could not pardon him as she'd intended. She had dragged the wine cellar behind her horse until there was nothing left of him.
Didn't the man who brought him deserve the same?
This is Jorah, my fierce bear, the right arm that never failed me. I would be dead without him, but... I can't forgive you, she said. I can't. You forgave the old man. He lied to me about his name. You sold my secrets to the men who killed my father and stole my brother's throne. I protected you. I fought for you. Killed for you.
Kissed me, she thought.
Betrayed me. I went down into the sewers like a rat. For you. It might have been kinder if you'd died there.
Danny said nothing. There was nothing to say.
Daenerys, he said. I have loved you.
And there it was.
Three treasons, will you know. Once for blood and once for gold and once for love.
Okay, well, was this a treason for love? Seems more like a treason in spite of love. You know what? Not important. Back to the drama. Dany banishes Jorah, telling him to leave the city before dawn and never return under penalty of death. As she does it, her heart breaks, adding Jorah to the list of all those she has lost. Her parents, her brothers, her husband, her son who could have been. Dario argues that Jorah is too dangerous to be left alive, and offers to kill him for Dany, but she prefers to let him go in peace, imagining him returning to Bear Island as he once described it to her. Spoiler alert, not happening. With that, Dany dismisses her remaining counselors and retreats to her bed. She tries to read a book she'd been reading the night before, songs and stories from Westeros, but tonight she finds them too simplistic and predictable to soothe her soul. Hey, don't talk about Dunkin' Egg like that. The book was a gift from Jorah, and Dany finds herself wondering if she made the right choice. Maybe she should forgive Jorah, or maybe she should have Dario kill him after all. Dany tries to distract herself by checking in on her dragons. Rhaegal, like any good cat, is curled up napping in the sun. Drogon is in his favorite spot atop the pyramid where the Bronze Harpy once stood. Viserion is off hunting across the river, his pale wings just barely visible. Speaking of white, here comes Barristan to bother Dany some more. He tells her that Kingsguard knights swear to keep the king's secrets. Those secrets belong to Dany now, and so Barristan can answer any questions she might have about her father. Questions? She had 100 questions, 1,000, 10,000.
Why couldn't she think of one? Was my father truly mad? She blurted out. Why do I ask that? Viserys said this talk of madness was a ploy of the usurpers. Viserys was a child, and the queen sheltered him as much as she could. Your father always had a little madness in him, I now believe. Yet he was charming and generous as well, so his lapses were forgiven. His reign began with such promise. But as the years passed, his lapses grew more frequent until...
Danny stopped him.
Do I want to hear this now?
Sir Barristan considered a moment.
Perhaps not. Not now.
Okay, but I want to hear it, please. They can't hear me. Moving on. Barristan tells her he has good stories to tell her about her family as well. About her mother, about her grandfather Jaehaerys and his brother, oh, Dunk the Small mentioned, about their father Aegon V, aka Egg, and most of all, about Rhaegar.
I wish I could have known him. Her voice was wistful. I wish he could have known you, the old knight said.
Me too, for both their sakes. Danny dismisses Barristan. Later, she finds herself unable to eat, and while she has sex with Eerie, she's thinking the whole time about Drogo and Daario. Afterwards, Danny can't sleep, and she walks out onto the terrace to look down at the city. Distant torches glimmered red and yellow where her sentries walked their rounds, and here and there she saw the faint glow of lanterns bobbing down an alley. Perhaps one was Ser Jorah, leading his horse slowly toward the gate. Farewell, old bear. Farewell, betrayer. She was Daenerys Stormborn, the unburnt Khaleesi and queen, mother of dragons, slayer of warlocks, breaker of chains, and there was no one in the world that she could trust. One possible exception to that rule, Missandei, comes out to check on her. Danny asks the girl to never lie or betray her. Missandei agrees, because what the hell else is she going to do? And distracts her queen by pointing out that the sun is rising. The sky had turned a cobalt blue from the horizon to the zenith, and behind the line of low hills to the east a glow could be seen, pale gold and oyster pink. Danny held Missandei's hand as they watched the sun come up. All the gray bricks became red and yellow and blue and green and orange. The scarlet sands of the fighting pits transformed them into bleeding sores before her eyes. Elsewhere, the golden dome of the Temple of the Graces blazed bright, and bronze stars winked along the walls where the light of the rising sun touched the spikes on the helms of the Unsullied. On the terrace, a few flies stirred sluggishly. A bird began to chirp in the persimmon tree, and then two more. Danny cocked her head to hear their song, but it was not long before the sounds of the waking city drowned them out. The sounds of my city. Danny holds court in the garden that morning. She tells her counselors that she hasn't made lasting improvements to Slaver's Bay as she had hoped. Missandei reminds her that she has freed thousands, and Barristan reassures her that Westeros will not be like Meereen. But Danny is worried that she has brought only the freedom to starve, and that she'll never be able to rule seven kingdoms if she can't rule a single city. Danny turned away from them, to gaze out over the city once again.
My children need time to heal and learn. My dragons need time to grow and test their wings. And I need the same. I will not let the city go the way of Astapor. I will not let the Harpy of Yunkai chain up those I've freed all over again.
She turned back to look at their faces.
I will not march.
What will you do then, Khaleesi? Asked Ricaro.
Stay, she said. Rule. And be a queen.
And that is A Storm of Swords, Daenerys 6. What'd you think of this one, sir?
Well, there's a new normal in Slaver's Bay. A dragon queen sits atop the Great Pyramid of Meereen, and those in bondage in the city below are now free. Dany has been on the move throughout these first three books, pretty much nonstop, from roaming Khaleesi to a beggar in the Red Waste, and now a conqueror, three ancient cities falling in quick succession. The only place left to go is Westeros. Unless, much like the lemon tree haunting her steps, Danny sets roots down here in Meereen, and in doing so, she interrogates what that new normal looks like. In a single chapter, Danny has to deal with strife in her own administration, a labor crisis in her own city, and burgeoning foreign policy threats from places she supposedly liberated. George is pivoting us to the nitty-gritty politics that will lead us into the quagmire of A Dance with Dragons, and test whether the enlightened despotism of Daenerys Targaryen can secure rule in the East.
So this is the last Dany chapter in A Storm of Swords, and it works really well as an ending, assessing Dany's journey in the book and looking ahead to what's next. George hasn't had to manage that pivot, like you said, in the book so far, because Catelyn's story came to an end. More or less, obviously she comes back as Stoneheart, but she's done as a POV, so no transition to make. And we also wrapped up Davos's story in this book, but those chapters ended on a cliffhanger that only gets resolved later over the next couple of Jon chapters. But he pulls that pivot off here, which is especially important for Daenerys because of just how much has happened for her in this book. That sense of scaling up is what makes her chapters in A Storm of Swords so exciting, especially because of how fast it goes, the momentum of it. In A Dance with Dragons, George deliberately runs that momentum into a brick wall to force Danny to function without it. This is the crossover point where Danny chooses to stop. The whole chapter is built around that choice. Everything from Danny's personal relationships, to her political status in Marine, to even her more spiritual understanding of herself. All of it informs what she decides in literally the last lines of the chapter. Hard to imagine a better way to wrap things up, but we've got more great endings on the horizon. Great last run in Storm, wrapping things up at the Wall and King's Landing in the Vale. All bangers from here on in.
It's a great time to be alive. So the chapter opens with Marine already fallen, a classic trick of George to fast-forward us past the action and fill us in piecemeal via flashback. Instead, the reader is put into the headspace of a triumphant Daenerys, who is feeling her way out in her new chambers, just like we are feeling our way out in terms of what exactly happened and what this new setting is. Where the Harpy once stood, Dany's dragons now roost. Daenerys feels a god from her garden atop the world, an Eden with the horrors of the real world just beyond the walls, the burned fields and orchards marking scorched earth tactics pursued by the great bastards. Daenerys does have a growing messianic complex, which I've mentioned before and I don't believe is wholly bad, or at least unearned. A combination of Targaryen exceptionalism with her meteoric rise to power on a platform of liberation, we'll do that. And here she is seen contextualizing that within the pantheon of other religions, from the Lord of Harmony on Naath to Rolor and the Seven. This consideration may have serious political considerations down the road. Daenerys will likely ride into Westeros with a spiritually diverse coalition, maybe dominated by Red God worshippers, but also those of competing Eastern religions and others who simply see Daenerys as their god. This will run up against the Faith of the Seven in Westeros, which is also a rising power as last seen in Feast Dance, and Dany will have to determine how to consolidate power around her person while still allowing these religious sects to view her as a legitimate leader. So for her first court, Dany embraces the conqueror aesthetic, one dripped in Targaryen symbology with a three-dragon crown and clothed in purple and silver to match the Dragon Lord's iconic eyes and hair. It's a clear assertion of her family lineage, which Dany and the reader will delve into later this chapter with Barristan.
Like I've said before, I think Daenerys, more than any other character, shows you what George is going for with the POV structure and how he uses it to determine your understanding of character. Like I said, in the wake of Season 8, I think Daenerys' story in the books has more to say about the artistic presentation of violence than it does about violence itself. I think it is more about how we access and process and think about it more than it is George, I think, making a statement about history in and of itself. I think that's in there. I think he has a lot of historical influences, but I think he's first and foremost interested in how we see Daenerys and how people in universe see Daenerys. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, like I've said before, I think it's a very deliberate choice that we never see Daenerys, not so far from any other POV, even as a lot of characters show up in Marine, the way George ended up writing it among the many drafts, you know, he went through with Dance. The one he went with, the one he decided to make canonical, was we never see her from another POV. And I think that ties into how she feels about herself and how she's increasingly thinking of how other people see her. And we get this contrast of her inner monologue with how she looks from the outside when other people are, you know, spreading rumors and stories about her, as we see a lot of in Feast and Dance. And like you said, George starting this way after the conquest is immediately meant to make us wonder what happened and keep reading to find out. But it also takes attention away from Dany as a conqueror, as she thinks of herself, especially because unlike Astapor, she didn't actually take part in this. Just she thinks she was kept a long way away on a horse wearing like chainmail just in case somehow something happened. You know, she was just, I'm sure she was smart in there, just having to go through kind of that pantomime of it. But by structuring it this way, George takes us away from the image of Dany as a conqueror, takes us away from how she might look, you know, resplendent in triumph atop the pyramid, posing for the history books. And instead, he focuses on how she feels, that being above everyone doesn't make her happy. Like we saw in Carth, there's nothing waiting at the top of the fiery ladder. So she's starting to feel alienated from her own actions, her own crusade. And George kind of takes the triumph away from what happened by not starting with it. He could have focused this chapter on Dany winning a war, and instead he starts us with her fearing that she's always going to be at war. She's thinking of this, that the R'hllor has this kind of this dualistic framework of the R'hllor versus the other two gods, fire and ice, night and day, that are always at war. And she would hate to never be able to stop and never be able to find peace and to be doing this forever. And like you say, she thinks about herself in a divine framework, but rightfully so. I think it's kind of the only way to process what's really happening to her. And she's not, and it's not a power trip. That's not the way she's thinking about it. She's thinking about it as a way of measuring the gap between what she's done and how she feels, and measuring the gap between where she is and where other people are. Like, it's heartbreaking as she tries to very kind of timidly reach out to Missandei in certain scenes and try to get some intimacy going, or sleeping with her handmaids, but she doesn't get the intimacy she wants there. And that ties into kind of her political status in terms of what she does next, but it's also a great setup for what happens with Jorah and Barristan. I think George does a good job of showing that even as Dany is dealing with a lot of other things in the first chunk of this chapter, she's always thinking about Jorah and Barristan and thinking of the implications of their betrayal and how scared she feels, how lonely she feels, but also that she can't show it, that we're into the trappings of power, floppy ears territory for Dany mm-hmm. now. And she thinks to herself when she looks in the mirror that just so far as she could tell, she still looked like a little girl, but she can only think that. She can't say it.
When we're finally told of the siege, we learn that Daenerys' forces had to be innovative, like, say, the men at the wall in the previous Jon chapter. Admiral Groleo's ship had been repurposed into rams and turtles, allowing them to break through the gate. The ram was named Jozo's Cock, once again blurring sex and violence as the breaking of the gate becomes sexualized. It wasn't Jozo's Cock, but her sewer rats that won the day, though. A strike force that we would learn was led by Jorah, Barristan, and Ser Belwas through the sewers of Meereen to free slaves within the city and incite them to rise up against their masters. Unlike Daenerys' sack of Astapor, this wasn't victory from above, but a revolution from below. So we have to at least name check Haiti and their revolution at the turn of the 18th century, the first and only instance of slaves overthrowing their colonizers and establishing independent rule. Like, I guess we're not name-checking it. We're going deep here, boys.
Absolutely.
The slaves of Haiti, then called Saint-Domingue, were the possessions of the colonial French planter class on the western half of Hispaniola in the Caribbean. For over a century, those settlers imported slaves from Africa at an unprecedented scale to cultivate cotton, cocoa, indigo, and most of all, sugar. I don't think I can do justice to the scope or scale of atrocities suffered by the enslaved Africans, not to mention the indigenous and subsequent mulatto populations therein. There's the theft from home occurring in Africa, and for the French, that meant specifically stealing slaves from in and around Guinea. They would be shackled and marched to ships at sea, some enduring the voyage across the Atlantic, some choosing to drown at sea, then live in chains, but mostly just dying from the squalid conditions and brutal treatment. Even though Africans had higher resistance to diseases than French settlers, many of them too succumbed from diseases upon arrival in the New World. Plantation life was overly torturous. Slaves were forced to work in the blistering heat with no clothes or other protections from the sun, minimal provisions, and under strict surveillance by their drivers. Harvesting sugar is also just incredibly dangerous on its own. Using machetes to cut down stalks would lead to severed digits and limbs, and the process of boiling sugar to get its extract left many more burned and disfigured permanently. And of course, every aspect of culture, individuality, and ties to Africa were attempted to be stamped out, a cultural genocide. And even the freed slaves or born free people of color were subject to one of the most onerous caste systems ever devised, taking race science to degrees that were Nazi-like, for lack of a better frame of reference. That ensured that even free and freed men of color had no legitimate rights or redress of grievances. The big whites, as they were known, also took mistresses and bed slaves from this slave population, not only leading to countless rapes, but also bastard children of mixed descent who could then be subject to the same system of oppression. And this continued at expanding scale for over 100 years, till 1789, when there were about 500,000 slaves on the island of Haiti. And that's all before the revolution itself, which was a struggle that would last about 12 years from 1791 to 1803, in which the revolting slave population had to fend off the colonists of Haiti, French soldiers sent to suppress them, a Spanish invasion, a British attack of 6,000 men, and another French invasion sent by Napoleon himself in order to re-enslave the country. And as you can imagine, the people who disregarded human life so much to institute slavery were no less brutal in the war they waged against those same slaves. Even as the British and French were at odds with each other over on the continent, the European powers had a shared interest in making sure that slaves don't get any big ideas about freedom. They had a common interest in ensuring European white hegemony in all things. Okay. I know I've been talking about this for a while, and I'm not even to my point. I don't think I have to impress upon you all that slavery is bad, but it's one of those things we just take for granted now that sometimes the minute but real brutality and horrors of it get forgotten. And those horrors are much needed context for what I'm going to talk about next. One of the darkest and most debated moments of the Haitian Revolution is the Massacre of 1804, where Haitian army leader Jean-Jacques Dessalines did a pogrom against all the white Europeans in the country, killing anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000 people. This quote-unquote barbaric violence is unspeakable to Western minds, then and now, and this stain would stick to Dessalines even as he rose to be Emperor Jacques I of Haiti. It would gain notoriety in the United States, where the Southern planter class would live in fear of something similar happening to them by revolting or emancipated slaves. I think it's worth considering that 100 years of brutal slavery in conjunction with the war of suppression by the French, all against a liberalized caste system ideology that made clear that white people were at the top and blacks and slaves at the bottom. This isn't to condone anything, but to put these sort of things into the proper situation. Because without that context, it becomes whitewashed, and it becomes a pretext to call black and brown men animals and thus justifies further imperial or colonialism against those populations. Much like with the Reign of Terror over in Haiti's former colonial overlord of France, we in the West are often taught the conservative history where this massacre, or say the terror, is treated as equal to or even in excess of the centuries-long oppression and massacres at the hand of feudalism, colonialism, and chattel slavery. And I bring this up, of course, because Daenerys crucifies 163 of the great masters of Meereen, one for each dead child that pointed Dany's way to the city. Like with Dessalines, this will follow Dany for the rest of her life, feeding theories about whether she possesses a whiff of that Targaryen madness or just generally whether she's fit to rule. Dany thinks to herself that it's just, that it's for the children, which juxtaposes less than favorably against, say, what Ned Stark does for the children. We, the reader, aren't meant to be comfortable with her violence, just like Dany isn't totally convinced of her own self-righteousness here. But I'd like to come to her defense. Half because I like sounding insane, half because I think it's worth facing the truth of what overthrowing violent systems looks like. Like with Dessalines' March Through Haiti or the Reign of Terror, it's easier to focus and thus demonize a single moment in time rather than systems of oppression spanning centuries which preceded it. As my boy Karis Nemec, played by Alex Lawther in the critically acclaimed Andor series, the pace of oppression outstrips our ability to understand it. It's easier to hide behind 40 atrocities than a single incident. Being a former colony of Old Guise, Meereen's tradition of slavery is so old it predates the Valyrian Freehold, and it is widely accepted that it was from Meereen and the Giscari Empire that the Valyrians first adopted slavery. So the number of lives lost to slavery is going to be incalculable for our sake, not to mention the lives that would be lost by the belligerent actions of slavers through the wars of Guise and Valyria and from after the Doom. It's worth pointing out, every revolution, big or small, comes with a counter-revolution. The French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars were followed by the Bourbon Restoration, and Austrian Foreign Minister Metternich's conservative Concert of Europe that held sway for nearly a century. The Mexican Revolution tried to cater towards its more moderate stakeholders towards the end of the Porfiriato, only for liberal President Francisco Madero to be overthrown and shot dead by one of his generals, which would lead into further war. The Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 would have to contend with the conservative white armies before establishing the USSR. But for us here in the US, sorry to our non-US listeners, the Civil War and Reconstruction provides the clearest analog to what we have in Meereen, with slavery at its center. Daenerys has basically aped General Sherman's march to the sea here in Slaver's Bay, sacking and liberating along the way. Reconstruction was a failure in this country, as much of the slaveholding planter class that had driven the country to war in the first place were allowed to maintain their land, power, and wealth after the war. Had Lincoln survived, or someone like Benjamin Butler been his VP and thus succeeded him, the U.S. may have risen to the moment and pursued the necessary land reforms and enfranchisement in favor of freed slaves to reckon with the centuries of injustice they had endured. This would have required, by necessity, marginalizing, if not flat out eliminating, the former slavers. That they were not severely punished, the fact that they were not severely punished allowed an oppressive continuity to endure in the South, giving rise to Jim Crow and the Klan, and turning it from a slaveholding region into an apartheid one. So, like, I am sympathetic to Daenerys here, even if making it exactly 163 crucified nobles does smack of personal vengeance, a horror just as great as she thinks to herself. But it can't end there. Eliminating slaveholders is not enough to secure freedom and justice for those freed. There has to be political and social actions to incorporate them into society and reorient around a new mode of production.
Great work there. I think that George is drawing from a bunch of different historical reference points, and I think you laid that out so well in terms of contextualizing those acts of violence that end up having such a hold on people's imagination, certain people's anyway. It reminds me of the great Mark Twain quote about the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror, that he said, there were two reigns of terror, if we would but remember it and consider it. The one wrought murder in hot passion, the other in heartless cold blood. The one lasted mere months, the other had lasted 1,000 years. The one inflicted death upon 10,000 persons, the other upon 100 millions. But our shudders are all for the horrors of the minor terror, the momentary terror, so to speak. A city cemetery could contain the coffins filled by that brief terror which we've all been so diligently taught to shiver at and mourn over, but all France could hardly contain the coffins filled by that older and real terror, that unspeakably bitter and awful terror which none of us has been taught to see in its vastness or pity as it deserves. And I think George is very much trying to make us reckon with that in this chapter, and also make us reckon with what it feels like to try to be a historical pivot to change that. It's important to talk about the historical reference points here, not just so you can kind of appreciate what George is doing, but also because the way he wrote Slaver's Bay, I think, can be taken in a number of different directions deliberately. And I think what reference point you choose is going to have an impact on how you read it and at what you take away from the politics of it and what you take away from the characters. I think there's the reference point of the American Civil War, as you say. I think that's a clear kind of hotspot for American readers to think about these slaver powers, and specifically when it comes to Yunkai, your point about Reconstruction, I think, stands very strongly because they're, you know, Danny took as much took their slaves and took as much property as the slaves could carry, but left them in charge, and now they're able to cause trouble again, able to roll back her reforms. So there's that reference point, but then what became a lot more popular to talk about in terms of Slaver's Bay as A Dance with Dragons came out was the idea that this is George reflecting the Iraq War and other imperialist interventions in the Middle East. And I think which one of those, I think, you know, both are true, both have strong arguments for them. I think which one you lean on is going to change how you look at Dany in terms of the compromises she makes, in terms of what she should do next. I think either way you look at it, though, if you look at it, this look at Slaver's Bay as the Civil War in America, if you look at Slaver's Bay as interventions in the Middle East, I think either way you get Dany as America. Either she's the American state in the Civil War, or she's the American war machine in the Iraq comparison. And there is no direct America analog in the world map of A Song of Ice and Fire, but maybe the closest we get is just Dany herself. Maybe that's part of how George wants to think of her, especially where things might end in King's Landing, America being the country that has nuked cities before. But Dany, thinking about kind of the statement Dany is making here, thinking about her kind of her public political statement, what she does by crucifying the masters, which I'll talk a little bit more about later, but also the way she destroys her ships to get in, that's the source of her siege engines. That's her, even before we get to the end of the chapter, she's already kind of made the decision before making it. That's her saying, we're going to stay. I'm giving up my way of sailing across the sea home to home. It's the same decision Nymeria makes in the backstory when she brings her Rhoynish people to Dorne, gets rid of all their boats, so they can't go back. Also what one faction of the elves does in the Silmarillion to kind of make it so that we're stuck here on Middle-earth, we're not going back to paradise, this is our home. And the sexual imagery there in Dany's actual siege tactics of Joso's cock breaking through the gate, that ties into Jorah's sexual interest in Dany versus kind of Barristan's more symbolic white purity. Who knows if Barristan has ever had sex? I lean towards no. but also, Meereen itself will challenge Dany sexually. That a lot of the ways that George expresses Dany's growing frustration in Meereen is through sex, is through how she feels about Daario versus Hisdar versus Quentin. So that imagery is, I think, is appropriate. It's something he builds on as the story keeps going.
I love that Dany as America bit. I really need Alec Baldwin to show up in The Winds of Winter and call her the living manifestation of destiny.
Pretty much.
Right before she marches back west. In holding her first court, one thing Daenerys needs to do symbolically is break continuity with the Harpy. That is the symbol of the slavers of Meereen. As already discussed, she's wearing her best Targaryen fit and sits herself upon a humble bench, which doesn't project power per se, but maybe a bit of humility.
Yeah, this is an important moment. This is George, I think, taking the complexity, the ambiguity about Dany's character, and just boiling it down to this single symbol. Because on one hand, hell yeah, break that throne. Use it for firewood. That's great. Use it for something practical rather than just symbolic. But on the symbolic level, like you said, the bench denotes humility. I'm not better than you. Just come and sit and we'll talk things through. Freedom is what's going to make us equal. That's her kind of trying to live up to that promise. On the other hand, it's not for nothing that George writes about the Meereenese muttering, well, that isn't queenly behavior. Because, yeah, they're right. It's not. And that's the tension that grows in A Dance with Dragons. As Dany kind of builds on this moment, she starts wondering if she's equipped to rule the world after she saves it. Part of the contradiction here is that Dany is leading a rebellion with the end goal of setting herself up as Queen of Westeros, in which part of her job description would include putting down rebellions. Like, is she going to set the Iron Throne on fire too and just have herself a bench? I don't think that's the plan when she gets to the Red Keep. And that ties into her overall kind of political status, where it's this question of whether you can use the Master's tools to dismantle the Master's house. And Dany is trying to transition from being a liberator to being a conqueror to being a queen. And even beyond the moral implications, just logistically, those are different jobs, and the imagery is different. And that's a tough jump.
So first on her agenda is the ongoing civil unrest and Revenge of the Flies. To handle the latter, she orders the corpses she made in the Great Plaza to be finally taken down, and Missandei coaxes Dany into allowing the Meereenese to observe their own traditional burial rites. This is a prelude of the knife's edge that Daenerys is going to have to walk, most prominently sharpened on the debate over fighting pits in A Dance with Dragons. Daenerys is upending the socioeconomic hierarchy, but she is also going to have to determine what cultural continuities will remain, what can be folded into a less oppressive society, and what must necessarily be disregarded to enforce her own rule.
So the corpses of the Masters, this of course is it's a central moment for Daenerys' character. And it's difficult to talk about because I think it's easy to come away, especially coming back after season 8 and certain dialogue choices at the end of the show, it's easy to come away thinking that George is saying you shouldn't try to change things and you shouldn't try to rise up and break chains because look at how gross this is, look at how awful it is when Dany's going around and smelling the bowels and the blood. I think the important takeaway is more just personal to Dany and not so much kind of a declaration about change writ large, but more just that ordering death feels different for her from hearing and smelling it happen. And so she has to fall back on telling herself what Ned Stark would say, I did it for the children, which is true. She did it one for one, one master for every child. They brought this on themselves when they crucified those children, an unimaginably horrible act. But now she's left with a world where the children are still dead and gone. And it makes me think about the other children, the children of the forest over in Westeros, and the idea that the others might be them getting revenge for their dead, but their world is still vanishing in the way of elven races in many fantasy stories. And Dany's kind of, I think George is taking Dany's eye for an eye move with the Masters and making you feel, as she says, the avenging anger of it and the justification of it, and then complicating that by then giving that eye for an eye worldview to Cleon the Great, as he calls himself.
Yeah, let's turn from domestic to what I'll call foreign policy. The Astapori envoy Gael, arrives to treat with Daenerys on behalf of the new Butcher King, Cleon the Great, who'd like to seal an alliance with Meereen by adding Daenerys to his menagerie of wives. Just, you know, like you do. Like flies buzzing around the corpses in the Great Plaza, we are going to see who swarms and feeds off the violence left in the wake of Dany's army. Dany herself is dismayed that her little triumvirate was unable to hold power, and perhaps this is lesson one in ruling. Leaders, even enlightened ones or powerful ones, do not a viable state make. Without even interrogating these three leaders or Cleon himself, we know that there was no bureaucratic apparatus or enough of a military force left to ensure rule. This is going to be a major factor driving Daenerys to stay in Meereen, as well as a concern she will have to face in every stopping point between here and Westeros. She's going to come with fire and blood to Volantis, Pentos, Braavos perhaps. But what will remain after she crosses the Narrow Sea? The captain of the Indigo Star lets Dany know that, despite the envoy's sweet words, Astapor bleeds. The people starve, and King Cleon looks to continue churning out Unsullied, now using the children of the former masters.
And that's the detail that really kicks Dany in the gut, because those children are the ones she spared. Remember her orders back when she was unleashing Dracarys upon the masters at Astapor? She said, kill no one under 12. It was an act of mercy, acknowledging that children shouldn't suffer for the sins of their parents. It was a desire, as she says in A Dance with Dragons, to not be a butcher queen. And now it turns out that all she did was deliver them to the slaughterhouse floor. Turns out Cleon learned a trick or two from the masters. He doesn't want to overthrow them so much as replace them. But what really stings about the Butcher King is how easy it was for him to take over. We don't hear about him assembling a big army or going out to find allies like the Masters of Yunkai are doing. All he had to do was show up and kill Dany's council of helpless Democrats, and that was it. Which means anyone could have done that. And again, I think it's easy to come away thinking that George is saying that revolting against exploitative systems like slavery is bad. Like, see, Dany shouldn't have killed the Masters. Look at that. Haha. But I think it goes deeper than that for a number of reasons. Part of it is just that it's just the cynical but real truth that things can always get worse. No matter how bad you think things can get, things can always get worse. And George is showing us that kind of Dany's high point in Astapor can be taken away from her. I think it's also, putting Cleon in context, I think it's good to show the flip side with Yunkai, because Yunkai was a case where Dany did too little, clearly. Didn't do enough to disrupt the status quo. Astapor was a case where she not did too much to disrupt it, but just kind of left it there. And left this vacuum open for someone unscrupulous to come and fill it. And it's just a reflection that Dany has taken on great responsibilities, that decisions which wouldn't have a huge impact before now have a huge impact because there are thousands and thousands of lives on the line. And all of this is just within the chapter, I think, is just to drive her onto the decisions she makes about Meereen, to make her think, okay, clearly I can't let that happen again. What do I got to do? What do I got to do in Meereen to make sure that doesn't happen here?
Right, and that gets us to the captain's demand, to allow for limited slavery to those who want it, which is a bit weird for us to wrap our heads around, as selling yourself into slavery with assurances of living quarters and some quality of life seems to put Meereen more on the path to serfdom or a system more similar to, say, the house slaves than the field slaves in the U.S. South. We can forgive Dany and crew here, as Westerosi philosophy and economics has yet to truly articulate a system of wage labor, so this hybrid slavery model will just have to work for now. It kind of reminds me of Lenin's new economic policy of 1921, which allowed the Bolshevik government to engage in limited market-oriented policy to help foster economic growth and industrialization to help recover from the Russian Civil Wars. It would also allow foreign capital to flow in and help repair the country. Basically, the Soviets chose they could have a little capitalism as a treat.
Yeah, that lack of a fully articulated system is definitely what George is getting at here, along with the compromises that result from that. We see Dany engaged, thinking things through in terms of class, but also gender, and the long-term economic health of her government. But the people trying to sell themselves into slavery aren't going to create a new hierarchy in Meereen, something that she can build on, because they're trying to get the hell out of Meereen as quickly as they possibly can. They want the good life, but they want it in Lys or Myr or Tyrosh, because Dany has not provided material rewards to them. The point of a system is what it does, and the point of slavery is to provide luxury to the masters. It's easy to profit when you don't have to pay anybody. But if you lived quite literally in the master's house, you got some of that spillover luxury. You got nice food, you got nice clothes, a nice bed. You're seen as skilled labor relative to the rest and treated as such. It might be table scraps compared to what the masters get, but it's more than the other slaves get, and that's enough to not want to lose it. Exploitative systems thrive when they give you just a taste. Again, the difference between breaking down the old system and setting up a new one. And it's
Obviously, that's a moral question, but it's not just a moral question. It's also that the incentives are changing for Danny and for everyone else in Meereen. In moments like this, class status can become fluid. A butcher can become a king, but a free man may want to return to bondage. And I think Danny makes the right decisions here, that she lets individual people do what they want with themselves, because otherwise she's like, okay, so I'm going to keep them in cages so they can't be slaves. Like, that's a level of irony I can't commit to. But she doesn't want to let anyone sell their wife or sell their kid. She doesn't want to let people think of themselves as owners of their family members in that way. And there's the question of the tax money. And I think you could argue that by taking the tax that she's complicit in slavery now. She's doing what the masters would do. She's taken part in the transactions. But you could also easily argue that these people want out of Meereen. They're going to do what it takes. And the state may as well get something out of it. Danny needs money if she's going to build a new state, one in which people won't feel the need to sell themselves into slavery, where free men and women can flourish on their own terms.
All right, I think everyone's sick of the politics and history and economics. We actually have some Song of Ice and Fire character shit to discuss. Mm-hmm. Danny beckons her good knights, the sewer rats that won her the city, Sir Jorah and Sir Barristan. I'll also give a nod to Sir Belwas, even though he's not on the shit list. He did eat an alligator under the sewers.
That's a very literal shit list. It's a different ballgame.
Yes. So juxtapose, the two aged Westerosi knights seem very different. Barristan carries himself proudly and with renewed purpose. Jorah shameful and worried he's about to lose his purpose. Jorah can't stop himself from talking while Barristan waits for Danny's approval at every turn before continuing to speak. You can feel the opposite trajectories these men are on. Barristan Ascendancy, a character who disappeared for a while and has just now self-actualized here on the page in front of us and Danny. Jorah is on the decline, and boy how far he's fallen. He was not only Danny's guide since early a Game of Thrones, he was our guide too. It's hard to imagine a chapter east of the Narrow Sea without Sir Jorah in it, and now he's falling apart and doing such a bad job of endearing himself to Daenerys that it feels like he might fall out of our narrative entirely right here and now.
I like how George puts this in terms of time, that Barristan looks younger. He's aging backward because he feels better about himself. It's like he's lived up to the ideals of his younger self. He's taken back the last 15 years he spent serving Robert. Jorah, on the other hand, has aged all at once. Every bad decision he's made catching up with him and turning him old before his time as he stares down what his life is going to be like now. On the other hand, you could think about this as being just Danny's POV. Like, maybe she's seeing Jorah more clearly now. Maybe Barristan just looks younger because she's aware of who he is. She's not thinking of him as just an old squire who never became a knight. She's thinking of him as the greatest badass who ever was. Maybe he looks a little younger. The same way Jaime thinks to himself, was everything really better when I was 15, or was it just that I was 15?
So Daenerys tests her two knights, and Barristan, as we know, passes the test and diminishes into the west and remains Galadriel. The more interesting part of his testimony is filling Dany in on how Westeros sizes up the Targaryens. Viserys was Dany's only connection to her ancestral homeland, and everything she learned of it was heavily tainted by Targaryen exception. But while she singles out her brother, it's worth noting that Jorah was her other connection to Westeros, and it just so happened he had a grievance against the usurper's dogs, mainly Lord Eddard Stark. In all his time pining over Dany and uncomfortably encroaching on her, he did not deem it important to disabuse her of Viserys' lies in total, or at least not in a way that would reflect poorly on him. Barristan speaks to madness that haunted Aerys, as well as many of the Targaryens that preceded him. I especially like the phrasing, dance too close to madness, probably because it reminds me of the epic final boss music from Final Fantasy VI, titled Dancing Mad. I also like the bit where Barristan says he will only take a sword again from Dany directly. As someone who has only seen the Lord of the Rings movies, I get a lot of Theoden remembering his old strength by grasping his sword again vibes from this moment.
Yeah, it's that classic knighthood shit. The sword as a spiritual emblem, the embodiment of your best self. Barristan is a true knight in the sense that he is not a hypocrite. He really believes all this stuff, just like Brienne does. To him, the Kingsguard isn't just a fancy status symbol or a way of accessing political power, and that's Dany's test for him. Like, if you really are just here to serve me, maybe I'll make you my cook. And she never intended to make Barristan her cook. That would be terrible for everyone involved. She just wanted to see if he'd be offended. But he's not. He's humble, and he knows that's the test. All that stands in contrast, though, to what he has to say about her family. Unlike Jorah, Dany's beef with Barristan isn't about how he has treated her. Like she tells Jorah, lying about your name is a minor sin. No, what Danny wants from Barry is an explanation of why he's only showing up now. Where was he during those years in exile? If he's really a true knight, the ultimate Kingsguard knight, Barristan the Bold, why wasn't he defending Viserys, his rightful king? The cracks in Barristan's image aren't about knighthood in isolation, because he believes it, he lives up to it, but its relationship to power, as with Jaime in a different way. Dany demands the truth, and when Barristan says that the truth is hard to hear, that cuts both ways. He's not just talking about her, he's talking about himself. Look at how George writes it, with Barristan hesitating and stumbling over each word. Of course, it's just partially because he's nervous how Dany will react, but on this read, it felt to me like Barristan is really articulating this for the first time, like no one's ever asked him why he stuck around. Back in Book 1, Ned told us this story, that Barristan was dragged before Robert after the Trident. He might have expected to be executed on the spot. Maybe part of him even wanted that. Glorious death, go down with his prince, nothing more complicated. Like Theon says about Rob, I should have died with him. Roose Bolton wanted that. He wanted Robert to execute Barristan. That's classic Roose Bolton. But Robert said no. Barristan had committed no crime but loyalty to Rhaegar, and fighting well for him. As Barristan says, this made Robert a good knight, chivalrous and brave. Note that Barristan does not say this made Robert a good king. Partially because, again, not trying to piss Danny off, Danny thinks of Robert as the usurper, but also because it's the truth, Robert wasn't worth serving at the end of the day. Barristan is only here now because he's come to regret that choice. That's the truth that's hard for him to say here. But when it comes to the hard truth for Danny to hear, George writes that Barristan does not blink, does not hesitate, no more stuttering over his words. The reason Barristan didn't follow Viserys is because Viserys was his father's son, and that's bad because Danny and Viserys' dad was the Mad King. Has no one told you that? Barristan asks. In the same way that Dany hasn't been seen from other POVs, like I was saying earlier, her own POV has been limited in terms of what she knows about Westeros. We know more than she does. Not just in terms of the facts, but also the politics, the perspectives at play. She can only see her father as a martyr of the usurper's dogs, and we already know she thinks of Ned and Tywin as being on the same page there. She thinks of that title, the Mad King, as propaganda. And I get why. She's so distant that it seems like it's classic just a pretext you would give yourself. It's no different from the accusations that Daeron II was a bastard. That a lot of the Blackfyre supporters believe that? Sure, but I bet a lot of them didn't and just didn't care. And that's how Dany thinks about the idea that her father was the Mad King. So she denies it. But George does a great job here of just repeating it in her inner monologue as she's saying, that was never true. Viserys told me that wasn't true. And she's just thinking, the Mad King, the Mad King. It's hammering in her ears. Great way of showing that she's really thinking about it in the way that she never has before. And this scene is also a great little example of how the POV structure works. Like, from Barristan's POV, this is a big deal. This is the most meaningful moment in his life since Rhaegar died on the Trident. This is his redemption. But for Dany, this isn't even the most important part of this scene. She isn't even paying attention to Barristan when he swears himself to her service and to defend the children, whatever else. Mentally, she is moving on to Jorah.
Oh yeah. Jorah, on the other hand, has little wisdom or service to offer Dany anymore. She basically has a chance to upgrade from a disgraced pretty good knight to a beloved great knight with Barristan now in the wings. It's like replacing your power forward with a younger version. Mormont reminds me of George Bluth from Arrested Development here, saying he may have done some light treason, only informing on her movements up until Carth. Carth, Dany thinks, which clicks into place then that Jorah had informed King's Landing of her pregnancy, that the assassins were sent because of him. A book ago, perhaps Jorah lies his way out of this, but Barristan, nope, sell me, fact checks him about how that conversation actually went down, something we ourselves saw in A Game of Thrones Eddard 8. The betrayals are stacking up too high for Jorah to climb over, and his overly familiar entreaties absolutely do not help. It's exile for the old bear. Daenerys reflects then on all the people she's lost over the years. Her family, Viserys, Drogo, her unborn child, and now Jorah. In our next episode, Jaime 9, he's going to reflect on losing a father, a sister, and a lover, a son, and soon his brother too, in spite of House Lannister having won the war. Daenerys here is at the height of her power, and no character has risen as high from as low in these first three books. Yet at her zenith, all she can feel is loss and loneliness. Circling back to the chapter's open, George put us in a situation where Daenerys physically felt lonely, as a lone god high above civilization. Here, near chapter's end, Daenerys feels emotionally lonely, as all the people who have meant something in her life have now left it. She'll seek companionship with Eerie later that night, but as Dany will remark, it's not quite what she wants or needs in this moment.
Despite everything Jorah's done, despite the lies he's told her, her life is lesser without him, that she occupied this role that grew and grew, especially she lost other people. And as Dany thinks, she goes into this conversation preparing to forgive him. That's the plan. And somehow he blows it. Like, you know, Jorah's walking away telling himself there's nothing he could have done. But the truth is, he fucks this up to a spectacular degree, even by his standards. And Jorah Mormont is an Olympian gold medalist fuck up. He says everything wrong. Like, it could be like a little list on like Indeed or LinkedIn about what not to say in an interview. Like, just the absolute worst. He starts out by blaming everyone but him. No, I'm sorry. He starts by telling Dany that he tried to warn her about everyone but him. So right away, he's got the attitude like he's been perfectly loyal company man and she is inexplicably turned on him. When, of course, the reality is that he's been compartmentalizing this whole time. He's been Ernest Burkhart telling himself he's not poisoning Molly. He's had the fantasy in his head that he could make this conversion without anyone noticing. And he can't bear to watch it all fall apart because he's built so much of himself on it. It's what happened with Lyanna again. Jorah is motivated by jealousy, and also by pride, snapping at Dany that he is no one's creature, when really you should be trying to assure her that you're her creature, like that's what Barristan was doing. Jorah tries to draw on their long relationship, the love between them, more as equals than in service as a knight, but that actually makes things worse, because now all of that is tainted. She can't, there's no good memories anymore. She can't look back on any of his advice or their time together without wondering if he was always trying to steer her back into the spider's web. Ironically, Barristan actually benefits from being a recent addition to the entourage because he doesn't have as much of a relationship to betray. And yeah, like you said, he also has the advantage of being on the small council when the news came that Dany was pregnant. That's why it's important for Barristan to go first. His sins are purged, so now he can draw on his time serving Robert without shame. And Jorah starts begging much too late, really should have started that way, saying the ultimate pathetic excuse that if he hadn't informed on Dany, it would have been someone else. But, you know, logistically, I don't actually know if that's true. Like, there weren't a whole other bunch of Westerosi exiles hanging around Dany at the time. She would have noticed if another one had shown up. And anyway, it wasn't anyone else. It was you. The personal intimacy is what makes it so painful, as you get that great back and forth between Jorah's words and Dany's thoughts as they're both getting less and less formal and kind of getting to the heart of their relationship with each other. But that also calls upon the treasons. When Dany thinks, ah, and there it is, which is just a great little moment as she makes Jorah fit into the pattern of the treasons, which, like I said in the synopsis, not sure that really makes sense. Like, a treason for love, but Jordan didn't betray her for love, his love was what led her to stop betraying her. But the important point is that Dany is making it fit, that she's interpreting everything in her life through this. And now maybe she would have thought another way about Jorah. Maybe at this point he screwed himself. But as soon as she thinks of him as one of those traitors, his fate is locked in because she's like, well, that's what the Undying said. That's certain. Now it all makes sense. And now that allows her to get over the pain of letting him go, because it's not even me doing it anymore. It's fate. Had to happen. And so Jorah Mormont goes into exile for a second time. And my favorite part of the scene is right as it ends, when Dany has this little moment where she imagines him on Bear Island, describing it exactly word for word the way he described it to her. It's the homecoming she can never have. It's his house with the red door, and she can only hope he gets it back.
Yeah, and with Jorah gone now, Barristan gets to fill in the role of being the Westeros frequently asked questions guy.
Yep.
Allowing Dany to poke at her past and lineage from someone who actually lived it. While the madness of Aerys hangs over everything Daenerys does and plans to do, Barristan says that before Duskendale, Aerys was charming and kind and not insane. And plenty of Targaryens over the years have not only been kind and sane and wise, but many of them have actually been great.
And you don't know which until it's too late, which is the real problem. I think Dany is kind of getting at that when she tries to read those kids' stories and finds them too simplistic, too predictable. And she says, like, you know, all the villains are, like, visibly, obviously villains, and that's not real life. You don't know who that's going to be until it's too late to do anything about it. Like, sometimes you get an Arian Brightflame who seems like he was obviously troubled from the get-go. But then again, that problem literally takes care of itself. Egg is the one who brings the curtain crashing down at Summerhall. And we love Aegh. It's easy to imagine Aerys' reign going differently, which is why so many well-intentioned people like Barristan stuck around as long as they did, that they were hoping he'd snap back. This is going to be another lapse. This is something we'll laugh about years later. Until it wasn't. And we're always hard on the people who enabled Aerys, and for good reason, especially the Kingsguard, when we see those memories from Jaime where he's like, they were saying, we swore to guard him, not judge him, or we swore to protect the queen, but not from him. Awful stuff. Yet every time you find a Mad King in history, you'll find behind them a dozen Barristans. Not cruel, not greedy or corrupt, not even apathetic, just bewildered, just put up against something their worldview and experiences failed to prepare them for. Barristan didn't want to know because it was too painful, and the same thing stops Dany here, preventing her from learning something that really could help her. If I look back, I am lost, as she thinks, and she doesn't want to deal with her whole dream of Westeros being tainted.
Perhaps fitting, we close the curtain on A Song of Ice and Fire Act 1 for Daenerys, having bad dreams, running through her titles, and dreaming of the house with the red door. Like I said, more so than any other character, Dany has traveled the greatest distance, both in physical space, but also socially and politically. To pace out this extremely good book, Dany's big moments came earlier in A Storm of Swords, with the sack of Astapor at the end of Act 1, the real fireworks factory, in the most literal sense of the word that we've ever used on this podcast. That gave George some time to flesh out what is happening in Slaver's Bay, and for it to feel natural when Dany decides to park her ass down on that ivory bench. It is in these moments she starts calling Meereen my city. These are the sounds of my city. It's Kos Celeb. It's the pivot to Act 2 of A Song of Ice and Fire, and Act 2 of Daenerys Targaryen. She is going to rule and be a queen.
Even putting aside what we know happens next, it's a decision with real ambiguity, as we'll talk about more towards the end of the episode. But in terms of Daenerys' character arc, it's so well constructed as she soaks in everything that's happened in this chapter and everything that's happened in this book. She's slowing down. And she's trying to come into her own and make a decision that no one else would make. That makes her something more than a puppet or a coin in the hands of the gods, as she says to Barristan. She's standing up against what happened at Astapor, but also what happened with her father, as she thinks about, am I mad? Do I have the taint? I have to prove that I don't. This is something that someone who was mad and had the taint would never do. And she's also, the way Meereen is described really beautifully, it's like all the colors waking up with the sun, all the different districts, all the sounds. It's that yearning Dany has for something real, something authentic, something, a place she can come from. Like, Missandei has lost her home, but at least she gets to talk about it. At least she remembers it. Dany doesn't have that, and you can see, I think, on a very personal level at the end of this chapter, her deciding, you know what, if I don't have a home, I'm going to make one.
I think that color thing you seized on is really good because it feels like a real place. Astapor and Yunkai were monochromatic. You know, Astapor is red, Yunkai is yellow, but this feels like a real place. It has color, it has character. So it really kind of sets it apart from the last two stops on her journey.
Part of what George is going for there is the sense that, yeah, Astapor and Yunkai felt like archetypal or allegorical, standing in for certain ideas, and Meereen, more than ever in this moment, feels like, this is a place I could live, for better or for worse.
So moving on to foreshadowing and groundwork, one of the lines from this chapter is, one day, one of my dragons might not return. That, of course, is pretending Drogon in A Dance with Dragons, who decides to go off page for a long while and make a big dramatic entrance like divas like to do.
One of the best moments in A Dance with Dragons, for sure. And yeah, a lot of what makes, I think, Dany's story and dance work is how it's always filtered through what's happening with her dragons, killing a child, being locked away, or two of them are locked away, Rhaegal and Viserion. But yeah, Drogon being on the run for most of that book definitely, I think, stands in for how Dany feels kind of disconnected from events in Meereen. Like, she doesn't have that real, authentic thing. Because for her, dragons are her family, dragons are her children, they're her sign that the gods are on her side. That's the real, authentic thing. So if she loses them or has to repress them, It's never going to feel worth the cost. And yeah, you can see her kind of already feeling that even before they leave, even before they get big enough to go. And speaking of running off and not returning, for theory and discussion for this episode, obviously Dany makes one of the most consequential decisions in the entire story here. Not just for her, but for all the characters influenced by it who come to try to get her in A Dance with Dragons. So looking back on it, do you think Dany makes the right call? I mean, she wrestles with all of the reasons to do it and not do it. Do you think she makes the right call to stay, or do you think she and everyone else would have been better off if she'd left?
I mean, this is a tough question. I mean, this is the question, right?
Yeah, it's true.
I don't know what is even like the conventional wisdom on this one, but I'm going to say I think she makes the right call.
Okay.
I think a lot of that is me projecting my own ideology into what's happening here. Like, I'm less, like, from an ideological sense, less invested with her sitting on the Iron Throne and all that stuff. And I'm more concerned with her, like, taking care of these people she freed, as we discussed at length in this episode. You know, killing the masters and ruling in their stead is two different situations and requires work. Yeah, so I think it's fun and... You know, to take it to a little bit of a meta level, I kind of like that she stayed there. Like, just from a story sense, we talked a little bit in our little, like, Patreon preview about how she kind of becomes a MacGuffin, in a sense, for other people's storyline. And even though a lot of people are upset that, you know, Tyrion and Victarion never made it to Daenerys, like, there's a palpable tension, especially in the last half of... A Dance with Dragons, where you're like, oh, are they going to see Daenerys, or are they going to get there in time? Like, you can feel that pull. Like, she's gravity. She's pulling all these people in. And I think that's just really great. And in a way, like, the whole Marine quagmire stands in for the whole, where's the next book, George? Like, it's like, it makes for a perfect, like, avatar of the whole situation. And while obviously I wish he finished these books or whatever, there's something very, very kind of unique that we get to talk about this unfinished work in the context of an adapted and much discussed TV show and almost a decade and a half of theories and, like,
it's true.
The fandom to mature. So, like, I think ultimately Danny made what I would consider a moral choice, but I'm obviously doing that within the context of what I would consider my modern morality. And then I also just think it ends up being kind of a cool choice overall for the work that George is putting together, even if it kind of just sidetracked everything and we may never get the rest of it. It's like an interesting, like, I don't know, flashpoint in history just to have this work adapted in this way and left at this point.
I agree. And it's, I think in the way that Dany is searching something real and authentic in her life, I think George was also trying to keep Daenerys grounded by having her make this choice and really test both her and himself and see, like, okay, so what are Aragorn's tax policies? What does it feel like when I stop the conquering hero and make her engage in governance? And I think that is, regardless of how you feel about the execution, I think that's a interesting move, and I think the right move for her character. I think whether... she makes the right call on behalf of Slaver's Bay here, I think is a little more difficult. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to not read it through the filter of the decisions she makes in Dance. In the same way, like I said about Stannis killing Renly in Clash, where it would be justified if he then took the army, went to King's Landing, dealt with the Lannisters, but instead he sticks around for a month saying, I gotta have Storm's End too. And that slows him down enough for Tywin to catch him. So at that point, it becomes unjustified. And I think Dany makes the right call here if she commits to fully understanding the nature of what has gone wrong in Astapor and Yunkai. And I don't think she entirely threads that needle. So then I think it becomes a mistake. But I think for her to leave now, she'd have to be an entirely different person. And I think she's not only willing to sacrifice her people, but she's not willing to sacrifice the desire to help people and save people. Because I think for her, that's the reason she wants to go home. So I think she makes the only decision she could conceivably psychologically make at this point. I think the breaking point to another decision happens at the end of Dance. And it takes a lot of walking and sadness and visions and diarrhea to get her there.
Yeah. Well, it's nice of her to stay. That gives us plenty of time to hang out with Stannis and Jon at the Wall, with Lady Stoneheart in the Riverlands.
Very kind of her.
It's one of those things where if Daenerys starts coming west, then kind of all the other storylines have to start revolving around that at some point. Same thing with the White Walkers. Once they breach the Wall, you kind of really can't worry about too much else, or everything kind of loses its like dramatic poignancy. I think we get more books out of this, whether we get a finished story out of it, who's to say, but
no, that's a great comparison to the White Walkers. They are the two in the two directions, east and north, the two kind of Chekhov's guns that will change the whole story once they get pulled down off the wall. So that is going to wrap us up for our episode on A Storm of Swords, Daenerys 6. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review on your podcast app of choice, we really appreciate that. It helps new listeners find us. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get benefits, including early access to our regular episodes and multiple exclusive episodes every month.
You can follow us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, at Nauticast, ASOIAF, or shoot us an email at nauticastasoiaf@gmail.com, and you can follow me, at Poor Quentin.
And I'm Manu, at Manuclear Bomb. You can find me covering The Lord of the Rings over at My Brother, My Captain, My Podcast, where this week we will be lighting the beacons of Amon-Din. It's an hour and a half of us just playing that little music bit on loop. It's great.
Honestly, that's all my 13-year-old self could possibly want in the world. Coming up next on the Nauticast, my latest Star Wars episode for $5 or above patrons is out right now. Fourth one on Empire Strikes Back, covering the screwball comedy romance between Han and Leia. So check that out on our Patreon. And next up for patrons is going to be our next Fever Dream episode covering Chapter 31 of George R. R. Martin's 1982 vampire novel. That's going to be out for patrons next week. And next time in A Song of Ice and Fire, it's A Storm of Swords, Jaime 9, in which Jaime sends off Brienne with Oathkeeper, as well as setting up a bunch of other plots for the next two books. Dorne, River Run, even Jane Poole, we're playing all the hits.
It's really a load-bearing chapter. The entire artifice of Feast Dance falls apart without Jaime 9.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's the crucial part of the Jenga Tower. Can't pull that brick out. So thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next time in Westeros for A Storm of Swords, Jaime 9.